I've played Martina Navratilova and Hingis and every other number one player probably in doubles for sure. So, you know, I've ran the gamut with all of our top players at some point in my 12-year career.
So, but what do you think when you walk into that match? You know they're ranked number one in the world. You're where you're ranked. You're kind of glad.
Then I'm going to win.
There you go. That's what I wanted to know.
I never went into a match thinking that I was going to lose it. I went into every match thinking that I was going to win it.
Podcasting from WealthWave Studios in Atlanta, Georgia. This is Leadership Now, the official vision and strategy podcast of WealthWave.
Well, we are really excited about this interview today. I haven't seen this person since 1977 is the last time I saw her in person.
Wow.
And she's got, so Katrine Adams we're talking about, of course, the former president of the U.S. Tennis Association and the chairman of the U.S. Open, among other things. So this is her book. We're going to talk about her book. It's a phenomenal book. You can see all my sticky notes in the book. I've got everything highlighted. Great stuff. But I'm gonna read her intro because it's so good from the book. So I met Katrina in the 70s, early 70s. She's a few years younger than I am. We played tennis together in doubles at the Rod Schroeder Tennis Academy in Chicago.
Wow.
And we had a little team, Seabold Super 7, and Katrina and I played doubles.
Wow.
Remember, I think we were the only interracial doubles team probably ever in Chicago during the 1970s. So that was kind of cool too. But let me read her bio before we bring her on. After serving an unprecedented two consecutive terms as USTA chairman and president, Katrina Adams began serving a two-year term as immediate past president in January 2019. Katrina Adams was the first of African-American, first former professional tennis player, and youngest person ever to serve as USTA president.
Wow.
Yeah. During her administration, the USTA achieved a number of major milestones, including the opening of the USTA National Campus in Orlando, Florida, and the completion of the strategic transformation of the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center in Flushing, New York, which cost $600 million. Unbelievable project she oversaw. She also spearheaded an unprecedented outreach effort into underserved communities with an emphasis on Latino communities in an effort to share the sport of tennis with more people. As a professional player, Adams competed for 12 years on the WTA Tour, World Tennis Tour, Women's Tennis Tour. She ranked as high as number 67 in the world in singles and number 8 in doubles, winning 20 doubles titles and reaching the quarterfinals or better in doubles at all four Grand Slam tournaments. Her best Grand Slam singles result was reaching the fourth round at Wimbledon in 1988, which I believe she played Chris Evert, if I remember that correctly. She attended and played collegiate tennis at Northwestern University, majoring in communications and helping the Wildcats to a Big Ten Conference Championship in 1986. That year, she was Intercollegiate Tennis Association Rookie of the Year. In 1986 and 87, she was named NCAA All-American. Also in 1987, she became the first African-American to win the NCAA doubles title. Another first.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
That's incredible.
Yeah. In 1997, she was inducted into Northwestern University Athletic Hall of Fame. While an active pro, Adams served on the board of directors at the Women's Tennis Association as a player representative for 4 1-year terms on the WTA's Player Association for 5 2-year terms. After leaving the tour, Adams was a USTA national tennis coach from 1999 to 2002. She joined the USTA Board of Directors in 2005, serving as director-at-large and as the association's vice president and vice president before assuming the presidency. Adams was elected the vice president of the International Tennis Federation in 2015, and re-elected in 2019. You see why I had to read all this? You can't memorize all this. It's incredible. She's got a resume that's a mile long. She served as chairman of the Fed Cup Committee since 2016. She was named chairman of the Gender Equality in Tennis Committee in 2018, and in 2020 was appointed to the Finance and Audit Committee. She was also named Adweek Magazine's Most Powerful Women in Sports list in 2016 and 17, and Forbes Magazine's Most Powerful Women in Sports list in 2017. Also in 2017, Adams was named to Ebony Magazine's Power 100 list. In 2018, Adams became a member of the board of directors of Pivotal Acquisition Corporation. In 2019, joined Pivotal Acquisition Corporation 2, an emerging growth company. And in 2020, joined the Athletes Unlimited Advisory Board. Since 2005, Adams has served as the executive director of the Harlem Tennis and Education Program, based in New York City. A Chicago native, Adams currently lives in Yonkers, New York. What a bio. Huh? Wow. Katrine Adams, welcome to the show.
Man, I'm tired just listening to you.
Well, I didn't want to shortcut your resume because it's so impressive. And boy, on behalf of all the players that worked with you and played with you and grew up with you in Chicago, we sure are proud of your accomplishments.
Thanks, Dave. I really appreciate that.
It's amazing. Great stuff. Yeah.
Well, so what was it like to have to carry Steve all those years?
Oh, my goodness. You know, my back has been bothering me for many years, you know? It's a heavy load to carry. But no, it's great. You know, Steve and I just reconnected recently, and it's good to see you, buddy.
Yeah, it's been a long time, definitely. Well, you know, you talk, this book is so well written, and I really recommend anyone, and of course, everyone watching this pretty much is a leadership position in financial services of some kind. Read this book because it the perspective is very different. And I love the way you talk about mentorship, for example, is so important, as you know. And you talk about this extensively in this book. And some of your mentors are people like Billie Jean King and David Dinkins, the former mayor of New York. Talk about, if you would, a little bit about mentorship and what it meant to your career.
Well, it's so important to have someone that you can just reach out and touch, if you will. And you can pick up the phone, you can text, you can go have lunch or brunch with someone and have some conversations, some intelligent conversations about giving you some advice and some direction in many areas that we may be moving towards. So, you know, to have someone like Billie Jean King or Mayor David Dinkins by my side is just huge.
That's fantastic. Mentorship is so important in financial services.
Well, it is. Any business, really. I think that if you want to be successful, if you find somebody who's successful and somebody you can look up to and they're willing to work with you, that's just as good as it gets.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Another theme you touch on pretty heavily in this book, and I really enjoyed this part. It was one of my favorite parts of the book, was sportsmanship. And you talk about, you know, how tennis taught you a lot about being a good sport and shaking hands and that type of thing. And you talked about Serena and Venus Williams, of course, with the Serena Williams incident, what happened at the U.S. Open a few years ago. Talk about that a little bit, about sportsmanship and what that's meant to your career as a leader.
Well, you know, that's what our sport is all about, tennis, right? It's built on sportsmanship. You're calling your own lines. You're applauding good shots, and you're being fair in how you play the match. And, you know, I think we've actually gotten away from that in recent years with our juniors and our parents and coaches, because it's almost about winning at all costs now. But that's not the way that we can survive in life. And the life skills that we're learning through the sport of tennis is what prepares us for the business world or the real world, if you will, after you are done playing. So sportsmanship is huge. I mean, just to be able to look someone in the eye and say great match or congratulations says a lot about that person. We've seen a lot of times where players are just kind of roll their eyes or barely shaking hands after the end of the match. And it tells a lot about that individual.
Well, I know you. I remember seeing the press, and I was doing some press myself during that time when Serena Williams had kind of a little bit of a meltdown with the umpire, with the coaching thing. And I knew even when I was doing press, and I did mention your name a few times, but I knew you were in kind of a tough spot since Serena's African American. You're the president of the USTA at that time as an African American. Tell us how you navigate. You did a great job navigating that in the press, by the way. But I was wondering how you were going to do it, because I know that you're friends with Serena and I know that you respect her greatly and all that. But it was kind of a tough call with the chair umpire. And can you talk about how you navigated that as a leader of this gigantic association?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really had nothing to do with Serena being African American. I mean, she's the greatest player of all time. So it was about what happened on the court and how it was navigated between the umpire and herself. You know, she kind of took it to another direction outside of what was happening on the court and really addressing and questioning her character, which then turned around to address the character of the chair umpire at the time. But, you know, I was criticized for perhaps supporting a black woman, and people didn't take note that Naomi Osaka is also a black woman. So it had nothing to do with race. It was really about, you know, it was unfortunate what happened, the circumstances of what happened during the match to kind of take away the great play from both players in that final.
Well, I forget where you were on some CBS or you were on some show. And I remember when they said, you know, you and I both know, of course, the players, the coaches coach the players. I mean, they give them hand signals. You and I both know that happens every day. So we know that, you know, they do it. So whether she took it or not, it just puts you in a pretty precarious position as the leader of the governing body of tennis in the country, you know, because you know that she's looking at the coach, but is she taking the direction? Is she taking the coaching? Who knows? But I just wondered how you did a good job with that. And I just wondered how you navigated that, knowing that the coaches actually do that in the stands, even though they can't really do it legally. That's a tough place to be.
Yeah, it is. But that's what they do. And I mean, the fact that he said he was coaching is one thing. But I mean, I'm a player, a former player. You know, I've had many people in the box. And just because I'm looking towards my box, you don't know who I'm looking at. So she could have been looking at her sister or, you know, her agent or her husband. Could have been a lot of different people that she was looking at that moment when he was giving the hand signals. So, you know, I'm not going to, only she knows if she saw it or not. And that's, you know, that's the situation. But again, it was also happening in the other coach's box as well. And so I think the world was saying, why not give both players a soft warning on the side to say, hey, I see a lot of activity in your boxes from your coaches. Tell them to settle down or I'll have to go into the code. And that's where, you know, excuse me. That's where, you know, for her, she's like, you got to be kidding me. That you know, she heard it, but she didn't really digest that I actually got a warning for coaching because she's like, I didn't even see it. So that's the challenge, and it happens, you know, over and over again. And you can see that coaching is starting to be allowed even more so in the tournaments on the end of the court. You know, the women used to have them come out on the court, and now they can talk openly from the end of the court that their player is on. So it things are changing.
Yeah, you know how it is, too. You're right. You look in the stands and you see your coach and you know what they're thinking anyway. They don't even have to give you signals. You know by their facial expression from so many years of working with them, right? And how is it like that in financial services with entrepreneurs?
Well, I think that it's very similar. You know, we don't have any rules. You can't coach. But often the people that do the best and are most successful kind of get a mind of their own. And you wish they'd take a little more coaching sometimes.
Yeah.
But we try and inspire them the best we can. And of course, always following the rules because it's such an important... sports is one thing, but business, especially financial services, is so important. It's somebody's money. It's somebody's livelihood. So you've really got a lot of responsibility, and we try and live up to it.
Sure, sure. Hey, Katrina, talk about that a little bit because that's something else you brought up in the book. And, of course, you paid homage, as I said, to your mentors. Of course, we had the same coach for a couple of years there, Rod Schroeder, at TAM Tennis Club. Talk about, if you would, the importance of coaching to your career, people that kind of guided you, because you have had a lot of coaching, it sounds like, and it sounds like you're very coachable. Can you talk about that part, too, and the importance of being coachable?
Yeah, so I have what I call my personal board, and this is a group of friends and colleagues that I can lean on who have expertise in areas that I'm not an expert in. And so I can ask questions, lean on them, get advice in certain areas to see if I'm going down the right path or not. And I've also had an executive coach. I mean, I'm a professional athlete. And when I came into the business side, or really into this role as a president of the USTA, before I went in, knowing I was going in, I actually sought training from an executive coach to help prepare me for those moments of intense, you know, debate or what have you, to give me some guidance in those areas. So I think everyone at some point needs that kind of executive coaching because, you know, when you're talking about business, at the end of the day, it's about trust. You need to trust the person that you're doing business with that's guiding you along the way. And that is very important for everyone, no matter what level they are in the business space.
That makes sense. You always talk about your team being coachable. Well, can you talk about that?
And it's
bit?
Not just coachable. I think people need to get the sense that you have their back. And I think that may have been the delicate situation she was in working with Serena like that, trying to figure out how to make sure that she knew she had her back. But also, there's rules, and you got to follow the rules. So that's the balancing act. And leadership's always that way. But if the players, if the team know that you've got their back, that you're behind them all the way, and they just have to do their part, it always works out.
So the coachability is so important.
You have to be.
Yeah. You know, one of the themes that, and you tell me if I'm wrong, Katrina, because I just finished the book a couple days ago. One of the themes that runs through the book, and you don't really, I don't think you really hit it over the head, but it seemed to me, I got the feeling that there was a sense of loneliness throughout your career where you felt like, and you tell, I'm paraphrasing, I'm making this up based on sort of reading between the lines, if you will, or at least my perception, that there was some loneliness in your career growing up, of course, in, on the junior circuit, as we both did, and then playing college and then going pro and not having a normal childhood like neither one of us had, and relationships later on when you were traveling the world as a pro player. Am I misinterpreting that, or can you talk a little bit about that? Because you talk a little bit about it in the book, but it seems like it's kind of a pervasive theme as the book goes through.
Yeah, I wouldn't characterize it as lonely. I was never lonely because I was always surrounded by, you know, friends, a coach, a parent, someone that traveled with me. There are players that have been lonely out on the tour, but, you know, what I was really, really trying to relay is that, you know, there are choices that we make, and I wouldn't change any of those choices that I've made because I probably wouldn't be having this conversation with you right now. And so it's a matter of how you interpret, you know, I don't know what a normal childhood feels like. I know what it looks like from my friends, but I don't know what it feels like. And I'm not saying that that would have been right for me. I had goals. I had a trajectory that I was on. I was able to succeed. I'm still in that space. And I'm very pleased and comfortable with who I am and where I am.
Yeah, I didn't know we were, when we were growing up, I didn't know we were so weird that we were living a, didn't it feel normal to you or did when you were growing up, or did it feel strange?
No, it was absolutely normal because my friends were my tennis peers.
Right,
so
right.
I didn't feel lonely at all. I was always with my peers who were my friends that just may not have been my neighborhood friends. That's all.
Sure. Yeah, I didn't feel weird either until I got older and looked back and realized, well, that was a strange upbringing, although it was a great one for sure. But one of the things you address is you talk about being, you know, one of the only African-Americans, and you know, growing up in like Chicago, for example, on the junior circuit. And the only African-Americans I can remember, literally back in our Chicago days, were you and Eric Smith. If you remember Eric Smith from Chicago?
Yeah.
I used to play Eric every weekend. It seemed like, yeah, great guy. And then a couple others maybe, but there weren't too many black players. And you kind of talk a little bit about, you know, sometimes being in the room where you're the only female executive or the African-American female executive, and you still have to, you talk about, you call it owning the room as a leader. Can you talk a little bit about how you were able to be a double minority at least, you know, in those rooms, but you still were able to be a leader in those situations. And you've been in front of some very big people as well during those times. Can you talk a little bit about the psychology of that and how you got through it?
Yeah, you know, I give a lot of credit to being a tennis player and being that individual on the sport, on the court, that has to make decisions, that has to be tactical, that has to be mental and physical to accomplish my goal of winning the tennis match. And so growing up in the tennis space, like you mentioned, I mean, you saw Eric Smith, Jeff Gordon, who was from Evanston, and he trained at Rod Schroeder's as well at TAM, and a couple other kids from the city that I grew up with were coming up there. But so it was no different as I navigated myself through the junior circuit as the only one, particularly as I got higher ranked and moved forward. So now being in that space in business and in meetings, it's the same. So it's a matter of me bringing my confidence into that space, being prepared for that conversation and knowing that I'm there to accomplish something, whatever that goal is when I go in there. And, you know, I don't back up. I'm not inferior to anyone or anything. And so I go in with that confidence knowing that I belong in that space and, you know, maybe question, do you belong in the space with me?
That's great. That's great. Yeah.
That's something.
That's confidence, right? You talked about, as president of the USTA, you talked about in the book about, having the presidential suite at the U.S. Open, and some of the stories are fabulous about how you'd have all these big-time, you know, business people, actors, you know, all these famous people, powerful people, and the one guy was giving you a hard time saying, do you know who I am, because he was wearing jeans or something. And talk about that a little bit, because I know that that's one of the most, as you've mentioned in the book, of course, it's true, it's one of the most coveted things in sports is to be in the presidential suite at the U.S. Open.
Wow.
And so you had to kind of turn down a lot of people as the president. Talk about that a little bit, how you navigated that. Because the people in financial services are always
psychological, I think you'd probably agree, navigating rejection and people, you know, just different things.
Right.
And because it's an intense business. And how did you navigate that with all those big personalities?
Yeah, I mean, the president's suite has a dress code. It's always been that way. It's on the invitation. And one of the things that is now not allowed, or it wasn't at the time, were jeans and sneakers. And people, you know, they honored that. We had people that would show up and we go, oh gosh, I totally forgot. And if they had time, they go home and change and then come back because you're there for hours. Or they had an option to go next door to our Ralph Lauren boutique and buy some slacks and khakis or normal shoes, whatever it was that they needed, and come back and have a great time. So this particular individual, he was not wearing jeans, but his guest was outside wearing jeans. And I'm not at the door monitoring everybody. I mean, we have a full suite staff that monitors this and makes the recommendations, et cetera. But they were really giving my team a hard time, and the head of the suite had to come down and get me out of my seat to address the situation because it was starting to get a little volatile. And so it's unfortunate that this gentleman felt that he was bigger than everything and thought he could basically bully his way into getting me to change my mind to let his friend in. And I wasn't budging because, you know, we have a policy. He wasn't the first person that was going to be turned away, and he definitely wasn't going to be the last one. And that's, you know, I stand by what's in place.
Big egos. So then you deal with big egos all the time, right?
I do.
In the business?
Well, you know, one of my favorite stories with you, Steve, is when you talk about the time you got to play Borg and yeah. How nervous you were and how that was.
Yeah.
So, Katrina, who was the biggest name person you got to play, and how'd you feel about that?
Well, she played everybody, jeez.
Well, in singles, the biggest name would be Steffi Graf.
Wow.
You know, she was number one at the time when I played her a couple times and lost in two tough sets. I've lost to Chris Evert in three sets. I've played Martina Navratilova and Hingis and every other number one player probably in doubles for sure. So, you know, I've you know, ran the gamut with all of our top players at some point in my 12-year career.
So, but what do you think when you walk into that match? You know they're ranked number one in the world. You're where you're ranked. You're kind of glad.
Then I'm going to win.
There you go. That's what I wanted to know.
I never went into a match thinking that I was going to lose it. I went into every match thinking that I was going to win. And I think the higher rank the player was, the more confidence I had in my abilities to go out there and play a great match and hopefully come out the winner. So, you know, there's a part in that, a chapter in that book called Baby Woman. And that was my nickname for a reason, because even though I was a baby, everyone said I always acted as if I had been here before, over and over again, because I was so mature at a very young age. And so I think I've always had that confidence. You know, I think I was born with that level of confidence, and my parents always instilled that in me to believe in myself and to believe in my ability. And I've always done that and continue to do that today.
You know, one of the things I thought that's fascinating stuff that you think that way. And that's tennis players are, you know, they got that thing. You have to have it, right? You have to have that mental toughness to be able to compete. No doubt about it. One of the things that I thought was really fascinating in the book, and I laughed when I was reading it, was she talked about Billie Jean King pushing her for the Althea Gibson. You remember Althea Gibson from way back? Yeah, one of the great players, great African-American leaders, to some kind of recognition at the Billie Jean King Stadium or a statue. And she, my point of this is, I know you guys got it done, but she was pushing you constantly. Can you talk about that, the impact of her pushing you? I know her personality is nonstop, and she's not going to stop until she gets it. Can you talk about how that impacted you, how Billie Jean King's coaching kind of impacted you?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that was something that for many years we've talked about, trying to honor Althea Gibson out at the U.S. Open in some form or fashion at the Tennis Center. And once I became president, you know, that gave me a little more leverage to add it to my agenda of my plan and my vision as to what I wanted to get accomplished. And so in this particular moment, I'm having brunch with she and Alana Claus, her partner. And she's like, okay, Kat, you know, when are we going to get this done? And I was like, oh yeah, we got to get this done now, pretty much. And, you know, Althea was always a player that Billie Jean admired and looked up to and respected, understanding the challenges that she had as an African-American woman in a sport that wasn't welcoming for so many years. And so she had a soft place in Billie Jean's heart. And that's why she was constantly saying, we have to get this done, we have to get this done, and you're the one to do it. And that's where I kind of got off my tush, if you will, and got the ball rolling and was able to get that approved by our board of directors and then ultimately erected out at the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center at the US Open in 2019.
She probably never would have stopped if you didn't do it, right? She'd have kept going after you to do it.
Well, after me or someone else. I mean, yeah. I'm not the only one that she went after. That's for sure. But it wasn't. I don't look at it as going after. I just think it was a matter of collaborating. And you know, timing is everything. And I think the timing was right in that moment, where it was really received well, and she got the recognition and honor that she deserved.
Yeah, and you had met her as a kid in Chicago, I believe, right? According to the book.
Yeah, in Midtown. She was doing a clinic there. I think I was 10 or 11.
With Alan Schwartz, right? Alan Schwartz owned Midtown?
Correct. And, you know, at the age of 10, I had no idea who she was. I mean, I knew she was a Grand Slam champion, you know, that she was a great leader. I knew she was, at that time, the only Black female to have won a major or multiple majors. So, but I didn't understand as a kid all of the challenges that came with that. It wasn't until I was a young adult that I really recognized her real story, her true story, and what she had to overcome just to be able to play in those tournaments and then to be able to go out there under extreme pressure and scrutiny and win. And so that's something that I fall back on, knowing that she opened up the door for me to accomplish what I've accomplished and the path that I've walked in her footsteps to be a professional tennis player. And now that I'm on the business side, it was my duty to make sure that I paid homage to her in whatever way I could.
That's fantastic. I'm glad you got that done. She's an important, you know, sports character, but also just cultural icon, you know, in general. Katrina, why did you decide? Again, I love the book. You can see I've got a few notes in here, and I highlighted a bunch of sections.
I appreciate that.
It's fantastic. I've written a lot of books, and this is a very, very well-written book. You did a great job. It's a great story. Why did you want to write the book, and what do you think people that are entrepreneurs building a financial services business or anybody building any business, how can they benefit from this book and from your point of view?
Well, once I decided to write the book, we decided to go towards a leadership book because I never really wanted to write a book. I'm pretty private and, you know, I'm like, okay, all my, you know, my accomplishments are out there. You can Google me and get all of that background. But it was a situation and an opportunity for me to kind of tell the story from a different perspective of being that only one, whether it's the only woman or the only Black person or person of color in a room. And it is critical that we have diversity of thought in these boardrooms, in these meetings, if we really want to be successful in business. I don't care what kind of business it is. Your consumers are very diverse. And if we're not speaking to them or they don't see us as leaders in these spaces, then perhaps they won't support us in the way that we need to, we need them to. And so, you know, the message in the book as far as embracing people's differences and respecting them and looking at them as being something positive as opposed to negative. Because here in America, we look at people and automatically have a negative connotation or stereotype because that's what's embedded in you for a very long time. And now is a time to really recognize the value that people of different races and ethnicities bring to the business table and how they can offer you in your business an opportunity to be even more successful. Because everybody spends money. And if you're not spending money or if you're not asking my community to support your product, then you're losing out on dollars and investments.
No question. You've got one of the most diverse financial teams in the industry.
We do. We've got people from all different backgrounds and all different ages. And it makes such a huge difference because the population at large is very diverse in this country. We all came from someplace different and different backgrounds and different hometowns, and the country's all melded together now, so we got to serve everybody.
Well, and the financial industry has been dominated really primarily, I mean, for lack of a better way to say it, by white men.
Right, right.
You know, but it's changing, right?
It is. It's changing, and now the only color that counts is all their money's green.
There you go.
Absolutely. Well, Katrina, with all the things you've done, going forward, what's next for Katrina Adams?
Well, you know, I run a nonprofit youth organization, Harlem Junior Tennis and Education Program, and that's raising funds for these kids to have tennis education and wellness to make them champions in life, not just champions in tennis. I've been involved with that for 15 years, and that's something that's near and dear to my heart because I did grow up in a program similar to that in Chicago where I got started. And so that'll always be a part of me and what I do. But the other things, if I started to venture off into some private boards and you know, expanding my horizon on the business side. But, you know, I'm a leader in anything that I do. So whatever I go into, I want to be able to make a difference. And I don't accept opportunities that I don't feel that I'm going to be impactful in any way. So, you know, being on boards right now and speaking engagements and trying to tell my story of Own the Arena, that's where my focus is at the moment.
That's fabulous. Well, just in wrapping up, what's the best advice you would give entrepreneurs? You know, Tom Wealthwave has, 500 offices around the country. It's a right. huge organization. And most of the people are entrepreneurs and financial services. They're getting rejected, as we all do in business, you know, building anything, of course, as you know. And people quit and people do all kinds of crazy things, you know, in business as people do. What's your best advice on you know, kind of lessons from your life and all your success that you would give to an entrepreneur struggling to build a business?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is believe in yourself, believe in your abilities. And a lot of things, you know, I write the 12 match points, winning match points in the book. And, you know, you have to own your courage. You have to understand that you need to be bold in all things that you do. And being bold is really just stepping outside of your comfort zone a little bit to expand your horizon. You need to own your voice, be able to speak up for what you want or what you're looking for, because we accept no too often, you know, and just walk away. And don't take no for an answer. If you're told no, understand why and go back to the drawing board and try to do better. I talk about that in owning your losses. As you know, Steve, we lose a lot more tennis matches than we do winning them. And we learn more from our losses than we do when we win, because we have to figure out how to do better. What can I do different the next time I go and play this individual or the next tournament? But you also know that every time you win a match, you don't even think about that match anymore. And so you don't really give yourself the opportunity to continue to develop. So the same thing is in business, but go out, be focused on what your end goal is, know what your strengths are. You want to always improve your strengths, but also recognize what your weaknesses are so that you can develop those to be stronger than what they are.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. So you're on book tour now, going all over signing books and that whole thing. So what's the best place for people to get the book?
They can go to Amazon.com, HudsonNews.com, HarperCollins.com. You can definitely get it online. It comes in hardback. It comes on a digital version that downloads your Kindle or your Apple. And it's also an Audible. So it's everywhere. And, you know, I think it's a great book. I think it's a great tool for industries, for companies to perhaps give to their senior leadership. Because what we're talking about or what I'm talking about in there is not about just the women understanding that we need to support each other, but it's also addresses we need our men to pull us forward because they are our biggest advocates and our sponsors to open up the door so that we can come into these rooms and be in these leadership roles. We don't get there alone. But once we get there as women, we have to make sure that we're supporting the other women and to give them the opportunities as well, because more is better.
Absolutely.
Very true.
It's a hell of a book, Katrina, really. The story is amazing. It's very entertaining. I recommend to everyone, they got to read this book. I mean, if you want to be a leader, you got to read this book. It's fantastic. I'm going to read it again and go through all my notes. And closing thoughts?
Well, hey, this has been great. We really appreciate you being on here with us. Appreciate all your insight and all your history. And this is a great book.
Yeah, thanks so much,
Thank
Katrina.
You so much.
Thanks
I've
for being here.
It.
And good
Thank
luck
you.
With the book. And on behalf, again, of all the Chicago people, we sure are proud of you.
Thank you for tuning in to Leadership Now, WealthWave's official podcast. If you like this episode and want to hear more, check out wealthwave.com/podcast or Leadership Now on iTunes. Join us each week to grow as an entrepreneur and succeed as a leader in the financial business with WealthWave.